There soon will be a new American face in China.
What does nominating Gary Locke to be ambassador say about the White House's new vision for business?
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. It's the Midday Update from Marketplace.org on this Tuesday, the 8th day of March. Coming up, how high do gas prices have to go before Americans cut back on driving and spending? Interest rate hikes could send adjustable rate mortgage payments higher. We'll travel to London for more. And an online calculator to help you and your roommates do a better and fairer job of splitting the rent. All ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
We start this morning with an announcement that could come as early as today. President Obama is expected to nominate Gary Locke, a Chinese American, and his commerce secretary to be the new U.S. ambassador to China.
And we all know that China is the world's fastest growing economy, so Locke's experience at the Commerce Department won't hurt. And neither will his experience selling American goods to China when he was governor of Washington State. Marketplace's Gregory Warner is with us this morning with the latest on this story. Good morning, Gregory.
Good morning.
Why Locke? Why did he get the job?
Well, Locke is one of the highest-ranking Chinese Americans in the administration, but he's also the ex-governor of Washington State, which is said to be the most trade-dependent state. Boeing's manufacturing base is there, also Microsoft, Apple farmers, of course, and other exporters. So Locke made a number of trips to China for trade relations with Washington. Now he's representing a different Washington, but trade relations is still the tune he's singing.
All right, tune he's singing. So what notes will he be dealing with over the next few years?
Basically, Locke's message to China as ambassador is the same thing he said as governor, which is buy more of our stuff. And you don't have to take my word for it. I called Professor Patrick Chovanec at his home in Beijing. He teaches U.S.-China business relations.
The U.S. is interested in China becoming more of a consuming nation, not just a producing nation. And the message that the U.S. has had for China is that that will be good for China.
And that's the message, of course, that Gary Locke will be carrying over as ambassador.
All right. Marketplace's Gregory Warner for us. Thanks, Gregory. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
So how is this news playing in China? Let's get that story from our China Bureau Chief, Rob Schmitz.
The U.S. ambassador to China is a tricky post. You're in charge of managing what is arguably the most important economic relationship for the U.S., yet a difficult one. You have to hold a smile while politely asking Chinese officials for the 100th time to raise the value of their currency, or crack down on pirated DVDs, or level the playing field for American businesses in China. This job is not for just anyone.
I cannot imagine there would be a better nomination than this one.
Wu Xinbo is a professor at Fudan University. He says, for starters, the Chinese public will be surprised and pleased the new U.S. ambassador has a Chinese face and grew up speaking a dialect of Chinese.
They will think that as an American Chinese, they should have better understanding of China, the Chinese society, and its history.
Wu says Chinese officials will also be happy. Not only does Locke's experience as commerce secretary give him the economic know-how, but serving on President Obama's cabinet shows he'll be able to deliver a message from Beijing straight to the White House. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Oil prices fell slightly in overseas trading today from a high of $107 earlier to the low, low price of $105 a barrel now. That's mostly because OPEC, Jeremy, is holding informal talks that could lead to pumping more oil into the system. Now, the cartel of oil-producing nations says it's trying to stabilize the oil market following the loss of 1 million barrels a day from Libya.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from London with more on all this. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
So what can OPEC actually do about oil prices?
Quite a lot. OPEC's got a lot of spare capacity, especially Saudi Arabia. It usually keeps a lot of its available oil off the market in order to keep up the price. So in a crisis like now, when there's a danger of the price spiraling much higher and damaging the global economy, they can pump more crude. The Saudis have already been supplying an extra 700,000 barrels a day. Now, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, and Nigeria are talking about pumping an extra 300,000 barrels too. So that would neatly replace the 1 million barrels that you talk about, the 1 million barrels a day currently being lost from Libya.
But Stephen, as you mentioned those countries, I hear countries that are in the region, at least some of them, that is in the midst of such upheaval right now. Aren't those countries vulnerable themselves to protest and maybe even revolution?
That's the ultimate fear at the back of everyone's mind, the nightmare scenario. If Saudi Arabia in particular was to see the kind of turmoil we see in Libya, Leo Drolis of the Center for Global Energy Studies says the consequences would be devastating.
Armageddon will follow as sure as night follows day, because it's a huge producer of oil, huge exporter, and it'll plunge the world into a recession like we've never seen for centuries.
And for that reason, he says, it's highly unlikely to happen. The world powers would not stand by and see it happen.
One hopes not. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks.
Okay, Jeremy.
Let's return to the U.S. now and bring in Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company, who joins us every Tuesday. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
So it seems like even with gas prices at $3.50 a gallon or higher, people aren't really changing their habits just yet. How high do you think prices have to go before Americans really start changing their driving habits?
Well, there's a big difference this time between real oil and turmoil. And right now you're looking at consumers basically kvetching but not changing anything. They're coming off of a deep recession. They've got some more money to spend, excess disposable personal income, so they're complaining, but they're not changing yet. They're just starting to hit the open roads and starting to hit the open skies. This year they're going to go off on vacations instead of staycations. That's where you're going to start to see the prices really climb. Then we're going to see how much pain they can take. I think the pain will come at about $4 a gallon.
Okay, so maybe this summer we'll start to see people change their habits. Obviously, higher fuel prices affect our driving and flying, but are there other things that are affected by higher prices of fuel?
Well, the problems looming are for food and farmers. Spring planting is coming up here. Fuel is a key component of it. Transportation, delivery, packaging, that's going to be a key factor, and it goes through to the food chain as well, so that's going to be a potential problem.
All right, Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company, thanks so much.
You bet.
Well, oil and gas prices may be on the rise, but natural gas prices are low, in part because technology has boosted production so much that there's a glut in the U.S. market. Now drillers want permission to sell their surplus. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
Drillers have figured out how to get natural gas quickly from U.S. shale through a process called fracking. There's so much that American companies now want to start exporting it. But there's a problem.
Well, currently in the U.S., there's 10 import terminals and no export terminals at all.
Matt Smith is with Summit Energy. He says reversing the flow of the supply will take at least 5 years. Some groups don't want to start that process because the U.S. may need more natural gas as the economy gets better. And if we send it overseas, it'll cost more here. Smith says there's plenty to go around.
The U.S. is going to experience a reasonably low level of natural gas pricing for the foreseeable future.
The one thing that would drive up prices is more environmental regulation. While frackers push to export, they're also waiting to see if federal agencies will rein in the very practice that led to the boom. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Because oil prices keep rising sky high, United Continental says it's going to ground some not-so-popular flights and nix altogether some new flights this year.
The CEO of Bank of America said that company is going to be dealing with losses from all the mortgages on its books for the next couple of years. So it looks like those toxic assets haven't quite gone away just yet. You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, March the 8th. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. Follow me on Twitter at Radio Chio.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson, now also in Los Angeles. I'm on Twitter as well at Jeremy Hobson. Don't forget, you can get the latest look at the markets by going to the numbers section at the all-new marketplace.org. And now, Steve, let's get to the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world?
Put on your walking shoes. We're headed around the world. For much of the financial crisis, we saw interest rates in the U.S. and in Europe at or just above zero. But rising inflation is putting pressure on the European central banks to raise rates, and the U.S. may not be far behind. Christopher Worth reports now higher rates come at the expense of homeowners, especially those with adjustable rate mortgages.
It's an early morning start for Georgina Hockley and her partner Stuart, who are busy fixing up their small two-bedroom bungalow about an hour outside London.
This is the master bedroom, completely plastered from scratch.
Georgina gives me the tour while the couple's dog, Poppy, begs for attention. Georgina and Stuart bought this house a year and a half ago on an adjustable rate mortgage. With interest rates so low, the payments have been affordable. But the Bank of England is expected to begin raising rates this year, and that means the couple's payments won't stay at the current bargain basement level.
We realise that it's at the lowest of the low. So, I mean, if it did go up by a couple of £100 or something, we'd just live with it and kind of take that risk, I suppose.
Plenty of others are taking that risk, too. More than 3 million adjustable rate mortgages were signed in the UK in the past 5 years. Jane King of Ashridge Private Finance says some of those people have cause for concern.
There will be people who borrowed, say, 5 or 6 years ago who are going to struggle when rates do go up.
In fact, low interest rates may be the only thing keeping some people in their homes both here and in other European countries. Marie Duran is an economist at the forecasting consultancy Oxford Economics. She says adjustable rate mortgages are very common not only in the UK, but also in Spain and Ireland.
The problem is that the countries where you have these variable rates are the countries where the housing market is already most vulnerable.
That's certainly true in Ireland. Brian Lucy of Trinity College Dublin fears a rise in interest rates could force up mortgage payments and push homeowners into foreclosure.
You're looking at tens of thousands of people being forced into either having an unrepayable mortgage or losing their homes.
And he says that could spark another banking crisis, as banks, already beleaguered with bad debts, would be left holding even more empty homes on their books. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
After President Obama took office, he pressed a symbolic reset button in relations with Russia. The move was supposed to help ease tensions from the end of the Bush administration. This week marks 2 years since the reset, and we have seen some major diplomatic deals come from it. But it was about more than politics, as Peter Van Dyke reports now from Moscow.
The two countries may have reset their political relations, but business leaders say companies are the ones who are really powering up. PepsiCo, Exxon and Boeing have all sealed billion-dollar deals in Russia in the past half year. Those deals would have been much harder, if not impossible, to pull off without better ties between the Kremlin and the White House. There have been no concrete changes, but Andrew Summers, the president of the American Chamber of Commerce in Russia, says the diplomatic mood change has changed the atmosphere for business.
Business feels more confident that they can make significant investments with less risk.
He says making money here makes jobs in the U.S.
American companies who have invested here have done extremely well in terms of profitability, and that in turn leads to a healthier state for the companies back home and allows them to hire more people.
Those hires could come in the U.S. high-tech sector. Biden will visit Russia's answer to Silicon Valley, where Microsoft is leading the way by investing millions. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
Lawmakers in Maryland will hold a hearing today about a new law that would allow people to eat outside at restaurants with their dogs, Steve. Kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
People that, you know, dog owners like to sit outside with their dogs. Sure. The sponsor of the bill, which is called the Dining Out Growth Act of 2011, tells the Baltimore Sun the law would encourage pet owners to go out to eat more often, give the restaurant industry there in Maryland a boost. Mm-hmm. So far, not much opposition for this. And the dogs? They seem to like the idea.
It's nipping at my foot. I don't understand.
Quiet, Chi-Chi.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, March 8th. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis, both in Los Angeles. Charlotte Bronte's celebrated novel, Jane Eyre, has been adapted for the screen more than 24 times. Did you know that, Jeremy? Jane Eyre, dozen times on the big screen. Well, there is another version that opens in theaters this week. So the question is, why is this classic in literature being made on the screen over and over again? Here's Marketplace's David Gura.
Jane Eyre has been played by Virginia Bruce and Joan Fontaine, Anna Paquin, and Charlotte Gainsbourg. In 2006, Rebecca Eaton co-produced an adaptation for Masterpiece Theater.
You just know it will. There are some titles that always, always will pull in viewers.
the novel gives screenwriters and directors a lot of room to be creative, she says. So every version is different.
You can either do it extremely compactly, just in the house with the servants and the crazy wife in the attic, or you can add lots of other dimensions to it.
Similarly, you can do it on a low budget or a high one. Either way, Eaton says, it's the story that sells.
I think Jane Eyre is every romantic, strong woman's dream come true.
Jane gets recognized for her intelligence and inner strength. She doesn't have to compromise. And in the end, she gets the guy. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
All right, it's quiz time now here on the Marketplace Morning Report. So let's bring in our quiz master, Stefan Richter. He's editor-in-chief at The Globalist. He's with us now from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Stefan.
Morning, Jeremy. Are you ready for today's quiz?
I am ready. Hit me.
It's all about tobacco, which kills 5.4 million people each year around the world. And my question to you is, which of these countries produces more tobacco than any other? Is it A, yours truly, the United States of America, B, Brazil, C, India, or D, China?
Well, I feel like China produces more of just about everything these days. But I took a trip through Tennessee this summer, and they certainly produce a lot of tobacco down there still. So I'm going to go with the United States.
Until 1976, you would have been right. But the U.S. is only doing 6% of global production these days, ranks fourth among these.
Okay, I'm going to go with Brazil.
Brazil is very close. Brazil, unfortunately, is number two, 15% of global production. But if I'd asked about sugar, oranges, or coffee, three other staples that you probably need in the morning, you would have been right. Brazil leads the world there, but not on tobacco.
All right, well, I guess I have a 50% chance of getting it at this point. I'll go with India.
Nope.
At least the audience now knows that I didn't see the answers in advance.
This, again, is another field where China leads the world in terms of global production. In fact, it accounts for 39% of it around the globe. And the Chinese are heavy consumers for once of this stuff. 27% of the Chinese population smokes. So they are number one again.
Number one again. All right. And I am number four on this quiz. Thank you again, Stefan Richter. He's the editor-in-chief at The Globalist, and they've got new features every day about the world at theglobalist.com. Stefan, thanks.
Till next time. Bye-bye.
And finally, sharing space with a roommate is not so easy. You ever had a roommate?
I've had just very recently.
Me too, yeah. Especially figuring out who pays how much. There's always that sticky situation, right? Well, battle no more, Jeremy. Harvard grad student and self-professed math geek Jonathan Bittner has come up with splittherent.org. This is an online calculator. You can go online to this calculator that, to the cent, figures out the fairest amount for all parties of the pad.
What do you put in your square footage of
your
room?
Oh, you can put in all kinds of things. Does your roommate have more closet space? Well, she's going to pay more.
Wow.
You know, is your window bigger in your bedroom? Well, that's on your dime. You're going to have to pay more. You know what the website, though, and I was thinking about this earlier, what it doesn't take into account?
Yeah.
The who pays for eating my peanut butter conundrum. You ever had that conundrum there?
You know, that cannot be solved. Some things cannot be solved by the internet, Steve.
No, you're absolutely right. Ham, you know, in the refrigerator. All kinds of food things not really solved in that website. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.